the strange land, boiling, bowling, paying pigs and bays. Rolling Suburbia, British Beatlemania, Old Miss John Glenn, Clinton beats Addison, Pope Paul, Malcolm X, British politician sex, JFK, blown away. What else do I have to say?
We didn't start the fire, it was always wrong, such a wrong desire. We didn't start the fire, no, we didn't deny it, but we tried to fight it.
But control of Ho Chi Minh, Richard Nixon, back again, moonshot, Woodstock, Watergate, punk rock, Bacon, Reagan, Palestine, terror on the airline, Ayatollahs in Iran, Russians in Afghanistan, Wheel of Fortune, Sally Ride, heavy metal, suicide, foreign debt, homeless sex, AIDS, crack, Bernie Gets, hypodermics on the shore, China's under martial law, rock and roll, a cola wars, I can't take it anymore.
We didn't start the fire, it was always burning since the world began. We didn't start the fire, but when we are gone, we still will on and on and on and on and on.
And on and on and on and right into the show. Here we are in the August 12th edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides, last year of the millennium, 1999. This is your free speech community radio. We have been going for, what, 4 years, 4.5 years now? No license, no censorship, no bullshit, or perhaps bullshit of different kinds and the sorts you hear on other stations, and bullshit you can challenge with your own thoughts if you want to call in at 427-3772. Lots of written material for you today. My tapes are not in the best order, so I'm going to be kind of floundering around. I apologize for that in advance. I've got a lot of good tape, unfortunately. Being kind of on the fly myself, I'm going to plead homelessness, which is a really bad excuse for not having a show together. There are plenty of good commentators and show talk show hosts like Steve Argue who do a fine show, even though they've been homeless for months and months, and under big-time hassle by the police, and they still carry it off very nicely. So I will ask your indulgence, and I want to remind you that tonight there is a meeting of the County Women's Commission. I am scrounging for the paper which has the time and place. It's going to be talking as the first item on its agenda about the May 12th protests. That is to say, the protests a lot of people have been concerned about as a sort of a touchstone of police misconduct and of the city's willingness to address police misconduct, which really the city has been unwilling to do, at least in the history of the couple of decades I've been here. It just hasn't done it, and we've tried to find a way, but no way has presented itself, and unfortunately the last week has shown no real improvement in that situation. There was a police review board meeting on Monday, as there is the second Monday of every month, and then there was a city council meeting, a rare, peculiar, brief city council meeting, mainly designed to deal in closed session, I guess, with a lawsuit up at UCSC around the garage structure they're building, something to that effect. But it was also being used by the staff to put onto the agenda the crucial seventh seat of the Citizens Police Review Board, the nomination of Cynthia Matthews of a man named Daniel Alper. And Daniel Alper is a co-owner of Hong Kong, Charlie Hong Kong's, which is a kind of a Thai restaurant up on Soquel and Seabright. He is a co-founder of Noah's Bagels, a huge corporate chain. He owns several pieces of real estate, and he's apparently got some sort of degree in administration. Now, I don't know anything about him. I left a message for him, and I visited his restaurant twice in search of him. I understand, if Michael Hernandez is to be believed, Hernandez said at City Council on Tuesday that Daniel Alper is off in the wilds, or he's biking with kids or some such thing, doing some kind of a charitable activity or youth project, which is fine. But in the meantime, none of us have any real information about him, had any real access to him, and his is indeed a key seat on the Citizens Police Review Board. This is a board which some of you know is sort of, well, I've properly, I believe, characterized it as something between a joke and sort of a sad story. It doesn't have it. What real powers it has in the past, it has abdicated, notably in the shootings of Happy John Dine and Brian Andrus, and its day-to-day workings sought to schmooze the police department and silence critics rather than address the issues raised by critics regarding the police, which I think is why it was founded by the city council. Ooh, we got a phone call early in the show. That's good news. It also means I'm going to have to turn down the ringer, which will require probably a blowtorch. Let's see if we can get this call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, Robert. I don't want to be on Free Radio. I was just wondering, I left a Lauryn Hill disc there when I left this afternoon.
Well, I can't help it. You're on the air at the moment. I will certainly look for it. Maybe if you call me during one of the taped sections, I can look for it more.
Thank you.
Sure. Bye-bye.
And indeed, it's one of our programmers, Just Man Jim, as I call him. He's also one of the Santa Cruz Five, who is arrested by police for asking uncomfortable questions in a loud and clarion-like way at the May 22nd protest. He's accused of resisting arrest, and yeah, I guess that case is going to come up in the months ahead. I have a calendar of court dates on that. And as I said, I guess I was looking for this Women's Commission schedule, and I'm going to keep looking for it because it's supposed to be coming up very shortly at the, I think it's at the county building. Yeah, here we go. The Santa Cruz County Women's Commission's 6:30 to 8:30 tonight, the County Government Center. And that is that big five-story building right across the river on Water Street. The actual address is 701 Ocean. It's 6:30 to 8:30 in room 510, and I believe that's where the Board of Supervisors usually meets. So check it out. The first item on the agenda at 6:30, that will be in 20 minutes, will be the May 22nd protest. And I believe video journalist and reporter Becky Johnson will be there trying to get a little tape on that. And she may call in with a report. Maybe also, again, we're hoping to hear from Skidmark Bob Duran later in the show from the town clock, where I understand a two-night protest, the Vigil of the Dark Goddess, which I have a flyer here for, Destroying Fear, Raising Consciousness, and Building Community, has been going on. It went on without obstruction on Wednesday night, and I guess on Tuesday night and Wednesday night, but until, of course, the early, I guess, Thursday morning. And Thursday morning, the police came and told them all to leave around 3 o'clock. And instead of telling them to talk to the goddess about it, they were going to stay. They all packed up and went home, or went off to where they were. And presumably they came back this evening. Although, again, the only information I've gotten has been from kind of Skidmark and reports from people this morning that the entire area was being washed clean by the presumably Parks and Rec or the city sanitation, whatever. If you're interested in information about the Vigil of the Dark Goddess, the phone number to call, and this is a vigil which is concerned about major change in the consciousness of humanity destined to occur supposedly August 11th through 13th. Women and children are supposed to gather at the town clock for a ritual, invocation, and downtown procession. Women, men, trannies, and children of all ages organized, clock tower with plans to stay through the night as a protest against the sleeping ban, the criminalization of the poor, the young, and people of color, and continuing police brutality in our communities. Learn and share valuable info with each other. Bring gifts for altar installation. Wear black as a symbol of unity. Bring art, signs, drums, candles, flowers, songs, speech, and love. Art, performance, and celestial magic scheduled throughout. Stay tuned. Join us in our movement for change. Protest the imprisonment of political activists, the control the police have over our communities, and the local and worldwide power structures that keep humans divided from each other in our environment and prohibit free thought, free speech, and free living. Create the world we all deserve to live in. We are each responsible for this world. We are responsible for making change. Are you ready? Peace, blessed be. Again, info and updates, 477-4181, 477-4181. And the number to call if you want to reach the Free Radio Santa Cruz studio and speak on the air live is 427-3772, 427-3772. I'm going to break a nail here and try to turn off the ringer. I think I have succeeded. It doesn't mean you won't get through. It means I will not have to interrupt what I'm saying when the phone begins to ring, because I'll be able to tell it's ringing by looking at the board and seeing a kind of a flashing light. Well, where are we? In Santa Cruz, with 500 to 1,500 of us on the streets without any place to sleep legally, rents skyrocketing, and I can speak from personal experience. Some of us are in jail. I continue to hear reports of just people taken out to jail again. The immediate pretext is this ticket or that ticket, this warrant or that warrant. The underlying reality, again, seems to be a kind of a criminalization structure, and that's really a matter of concern to me. Laws like the sleeping ban, like selective use of statutes like jaywalking, police determination to quell protests, and the targeting of particular protesters, like Steve Argue, is really kind of shocking. And there had been hope among some of us, not a lot of hope, but a little bit of hope, that the new city council, with its three new members who are kind of in rebellion against the old Rotkin Kennedy Council, were going to take some significant steps, having gotten a significant mandate from the voters, 64% of the vote. That's what Fitzmaurice, Crone, and Sugar, the three new council people, got. And indeed, Crone and Sugar, early on in November, attended a rally against police abuse, the shooting of Happy John Dine, and the stolen lives phenomena, where parents and relatives, and just relatives of those killed by the police, sort of got together and publicized the behavior of police departments that didn't get much publicity in other ways. And two council members, Crone and Sugar, stood up there with Steve Argue and others, making strong speeches about the need for justice. The next day, Steve Argue was thrown to the ground by Officer Garner for selling the newspaper Street Spirit, dragged off to jail and held there 4 days. Council member Sugar did nothing about it that I'm aware of, didn't call the jail, didn't visit the man, even though Sugar is an attorney, could have done so at any time. And then we, of course, went into the holiday, well, the three or four months of the humorous cavalcade, if you have a dark sense of humor, of the Catherine Byers task force to examine the camping ordinance, wherein she raised lots of fears among conservative neighborhood groups that she was going to throw out the entire camping ban, when all that some of us wanted, at least initially, was some kind of reforms around the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance. And she didn't even get to that examination. It was her way of arousing the enemies of change, really, and just retreating into a position of making a few face-saving changes, establishing this homeless issues task force. I guess she didn't establish it. It was voted in to begin. I guess now it's got its, most of its people are together and has its main person. It's a main staff person. Another joke, Don Lane, a guy who's getting $7,500 a year and is really on the opposition side of pro-homeless issues. He's been siding with people like Linda Steinau and Scott Kennedy and people who essentially have turned their back on the homeless and supported anti-civil rights, anti-civil liberties legislation around homeless activities. And yet he's being funded by the city. Instead of a homeless person in that position, it's Don Lane in that position. This is indeed just weeks after he kind of was a part of an effort and presumably was going to have a position in the Dolphin Lee project in the Beach Flats. The Dolphin Lee project was a plan by Mercy Housing and some elements on the city council and the city staff to evict hundreds of Hispanic people. Interestingly enough, the same Hispanic people that through their protests helped to evict the old city council majority. And all of this in the name of affordable housing. Instead of building new affordable housing and taking over Charlie Canfield's profiteer property, where he's driven residences away and left property barren, in anticipation of speculation, there would be housing that was, instead of taking that property, which could really expand the housing stock in the Beach Flats, this plan was to give Don Lane this position as a Mercy Housing person who would set up housing that evicted hundreds of people, essentially gentrified the area, even though it was being done in the name of affordable housing. And why this task force was, why Don Lane was chosen, is actually becoming quite clear now, because Lane is a part of this kind of right-wing ideology that apparently is business as usual for the current city council under Mayor Catherine Byers, with her loyal henchman, Tim Fitzmaurice, who kind of backs her up on one thing after another. You saw it as far back in December as his refusal to put any checks on the police department's arrest of sleepers over the winter, his refusal to raise issues of shelter when the issue of shelter was just incredibly inadequate, along with Byers. And his, this general, he's a, I guess, a conservative type person masking as a progressive on a lot of issues. And we again saw that this week. I wasn't in town for it, but I got the word from those who were at the kind of rump city council meeting that happened on Tuesday. And maybe we can get someone to call in and talk about that city council meeting. It was a very brief city council meeting. Most of it, as I said, was a closed meeting that had to do with litigation around UCSC and their garage. But there was a small section where Cynthia Matthews' appointee simply got rubber stamped by the city council, in spite of the fact that every single speaker there opposed making the decision at that time. I had a speech, which I'm going to read to you, which talks about the appointment, and I've talked about it on the air before. It's not that the individual is necessarily a bad appointee, though he probably is. Cynthia Matthews is really, you can trust her to be bad in her police review board appointments, I think. But more important than that, there was no public process. This is what they promised us again and again, that they have betrayed us on again and again. This idea of letting us speak at oral communications. Occasionally you'll get Christopher Crone speaking up, asking to extend oral communications, but generally speaking, Byers cuts it back. At least that's what had been happening throughout the spring and early summer, with a few exceptions. In this case, here's a man who is being considered for a vital seventh seat on the Citizens Police Review Board. Vital only in the sense that we thought for a moment in time that the three new appointees, the new three new members in the Police Review Board, might actually begin to do something, look into the use of pepper spray by police, look into the question of harassment of activists at political protests, really start examining through a more independent investigation and public hearing process complaints as they came in. Unfortunately, I'm really beginning to doubt if that's going to happen at all. First of all, the board is deadlocked 3-3, and now we find the fourth person on the fourth vote will be a conservative person, Cynthia Matthews. Even though Crone, Sugar, Byers, and Fitzmaurice, in a rare demonstration of progressive solidarity back in January, voted against Cynthia Matthews' reappointment of Bill Christie, who was the notorious chair who essentially rubber-stamped the shooting of Happy John Dine 2 years ago, the disabled man who was shot allegedly for wielding a gun or reaching for a gun, and that's a toy gun, by the way, depending on who you talk to, where every single non-police witness contradicted the accounts of the DA and the police chief, and the whole thing was shut up into a kind of into the back room without any kind of open hearings or public or independent investigation. Christie was rejected when he was proposed again as a reappointment by Matthews. She then sort of pouted for six or seven months. Six months, and finally came forward with this Daniel Alpor, and she came forward with his name at a time when there was without any information about him, without calling him forward. Though it's customary process, according to Scott Graham, a longtime observer of City Council, for the nominees to come forward and talk and answer questions from City Council members. And indeed, on Tuesday at 1 o'clock in the special rump session of the City Council, where even Cynthia Matthews was out of town, she wasn't there to make to propose the Citizens Police Review Board appointee that she was proposing. Christopher Crone wasn't there. Instead, Michael Rotkin, fittingly enough, proposed the nomination. And Everybody else voted for it except for Sugar, who abstained, saying he had a conflict of interest. And lest we think that's a hopeful sign from Sugar, Sugar himself, when spoken to later by Becky Johnson, had no words of criticism about the nomination, and only words of criticism about those who were critical of the nomination. His only comment was that Cynthia Matthews can appoint anybody she likes. And the problem there, of course, is that given that Catherine Byers' appointee is Lisa Rose, who is the woman who, as chair, carried on this right-wing tradition of simply rubber-stamping the police department, given that reality, the appointment of Cynthia Matthews, again, I don't know what he's going to do, because he hasn't returned my phone calls, and he hasn't returned anybody's phone calls that I know of. He's the mystery man. But he was voted on without any discussion or real information about him, other than the thin one page that he filled out, which originally the city clerk would not show us. She kind of read a few of the items off to me, the city clerk's staff, and I guess Becky Johnson finally got this page because after the vote, as a sort of perhaps a guilty afterthought, Mayor Byers, when Becky Johnson said, "How can you do this without any information?" she just sort of tore the page out and gave her the information after the fact. But there really wasn't much information about this guy. I mean, the question is, and perhaps the answer really was in the cards some time ago, and indeed, the very people who set up this police review board have said, forget about it, it's a joke. And I continue to say that, and yet I spend so much time on the air talking about the police review board. Whoa. Well, I'm probably going to talk about it a little more, and I'm going to read you a speech that was read at the city council. The city council meeting was not televised. It was not announced by the Sentinel as being as happening at 1 o'clock. Instead, they said it was happening at 3:30 and at 7. The city council meeting essentially was sort of a stealth appointment process. And I made the following statement, which was read by other people because I was up north. And what I had to say was this. The appointment before you today is a crucial one, as many of you know. To understand its significance fully, one must consider the history of the Citizens Police Review Board. The CPRB was first proposed by SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now, SCAN, the Santa Cruz Action Network, and the Coalition for a Citizens Police Review Commission back in 1990. Due in large part to Councilmember Kennedy's influence, the formation of the board was repeatedly delayed and ultimately fatally weakened. Public hearings and independent investigation were not required, even in the most serious of cases. In 1991, when Officer Lauren Baker was publicly accused of sexual misconduct with 9 different women suspects, City Council was forced by public outcry to form its own investigative subcommittee, which it quickly dissolved under pressure from the police department. In a contemptuous commentary on SCPD supremacy, Baker was promoted to sergeant and named Officer of the Year by the department soon after this episode. The CPRB itself, under the chairmanship of Kay Bowden, Bill Christie, and Lisa Rose, held no independent investigations, early investigations, or public hearings of any kind. In the most serious case of the decade, the Happy John Dine case, it made no effort to explain the discrepancy between its findings and the official reports of the SCPD and the DA. When asked about this 2 months later by video journalist Becky Johnson, Chair Lisa Rose's response was, "I do not remember the details." In the C-7 directive scandal, when board member John Malkin tried to draw attention to Police Chief Belcher's flouting of departmental policy, he was harassed by the department and left out to dry by the board. Sergeant Steve Clark smilingly informing Malkin that on paid public time, he was compiling a damaging political file on Malkin. Malkin soon after resigned from the board, declaring it fatally flawed. Celia Scott's appointee, Gia Grant, soon found herself the target of police charges and not only quit, but moved out of town. Currently, the board has a 3-3 division of opinion on crucial matters, such as whether the police chief must let the board see all complaints made, as was originally envisaged under the 1994 law. Chief Belcher defied that law in his department's own C-7 directive in 1995 and unilaterally rewrote the policy with the concurrence of a more compliant city council and the Bowden, Christie, Rose boards. Yesterday, I should say on Monday, under the new chair, Arnie Leff, half the board expressed its determination to be able to see all complaints against police officers uncensored by Chief Belcher. The other half, under Lisa Rose, sided with her and with police privilege. This is only one of many issues, including what the standard of proof should be in a police complaint, whether the dangers of pepper spray should be publicly considered, and whether police stops should be documented more closely to assure that racial discrimination and harassment of the homeless is not going on. Holdover member Lisa Rose has rather clearly indicated her position on these issues through her past votes and recent comments. That position is directly opposed to what seems to be the direction of the new appointees. If the board is thwarted in dealing with these issues by the appointment of a pro-Rose fourth vote, the council itself will have to address these issues itself, if they are to be addressed at all. Wasn't the board created to do this? Will council allow the will of the voters to be summarily reversed, where the balance of power is held by a lame duck council member? Finally, at the last minute, Cynthia Matthews submitted the name of Daniel Alper, the co-founder of the multimillion-dollar anti-union Noah's Bagels chain. Alper, I understand, has been in town 4 months. He owns a number of buildings and co-manages Charlie Hong Kong. To his credit, he has a phone number openly listed. However, he neither returned a recent phone call nor responded to several requests to meet. He has never been to a police review board meeting that I know of. I would not like to prejudge Mr. Alper, but feel, given the crucial character of this nomination, that the council needs more to go on than Cynthia Matthews' preference and Mayor Byers' hopeful endorsement in Tuesday's Sentinel, if that is accurate. Neither the Sentinel nor any media has had much information on Mr. Alper, and by the way, the Sentinel didn't show up at the council meeting on Tuesday either. Both the public and the council need to know more about who will be sitting in the crucial 7th CPRB seat. Matthews herself is out of town, as I understand, as Councilmember Crone. While I have repeatedly deplored Matthews' failure to make a 7th appointment in a timely manner, her 11th-hour appointment of Alper, which reached the council agenda in late July, was done with the same contempt for public process that marked her delay in making an appointment. She tried, at the last minute of City Council, which had only 4 members present, to have Mr. Alper rushed past the confirmation process. Even Acting Mayor Keith Sugar declared at that session back in July that he couldn't vote on the issue, leaving only 3 council members, 2 of them part of an old council repudiated by the voters last November. Because the council and the public do not have any clear information from Mr. Alper himself, it seems prudent to assume that Mr. Alper's philosophy reflects that of Ms. Matthews, that of the old council and the old board. To be fair to Mr. Alper and Ms. Matthews, more time is needed to get more information. You're also called on to vote at this peculiar meeting in the middle of the August recess at a peculiar time, 1 p.m., with virtually no one from the public present. The Sunday Sentinel itself announced there will be meetings today at 3:30 p.m. and 7 p.m., not, as is happening, at 1 p.m., further confusing the public. This is not fair and lacks the appearance of fairness. I have no clear sense of Mr. Alper's suitability for the position, and am willing to suspend judgment pending more information. But if Ms. Matthews or Mayor Byers insists on a vote today, the council's only fair response can be to vote it down. Councilmember Fitzmaurice has newly returned from out of town, and I doubt has had time to study this nomination. With Crone away and Sugar disqualifying himself, it falls on him to represent the voters at the last election who want an effective and vigorous CPRB. Another option would be to suggest to Lisa Rose that she resign from the seat Mayor Byers appoints and offer to be the Matthews appointee. Rose's philosophy seems more in keeping with Matthews' perspective. For those concerned with minority rights and ideological balance, Rose has both experience and expertise. She could continue on the board without exercising the balance of power that fairly should go to members appointed by the new council majority, elected by over 60% of the voters last November. I doubt the council has the will to do this, though I think it makes perfect sense and believe many of us would be vastly encouraged if the more progressive council members made a motion to this effect. Barring that, the wisest thing is, at this time, to delay consideration of the Matthews nominee until September, when it can be done in a more regular and informed fashion. Whatever our views on the suitability of Mr. Alper, he and the public certainly deserve an informed examination. And, of course, that's exactly what we didn't get on Tuesday when he was unanimously voted, I guess it was 4-0 with 1 abstention and 2 people absent, with Byers and Fitzmaurice, the great liberal progressives, voting for this man about whom they know essentially nothing, or at least are telling us essentially nothing. Well, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and I'm going to give you a break with a little bit of music.
We can start
that was really a little music, got to admit. At the last city council meeting where there actually was public discussion, a man named Fred Geiger spoke. Fred, you've heard on Free Radio Santa Cruz. He's a union activist. He's really a loyal supporter of the current city council majority. And he also, I think, has a good heart and wants to see changes in the police review board and in the laws that criminalize homeless people. He had some issues he spoke about, and we're going to hear a few of those as I attempt to get my tapes together. So hang with us.
Good afternoon. Fred Geiger, is this on? Okay. Santa Cruz? I wanted to briefly address some of the figures here so that people on the council and otherwise will be able to know what the picture is on this item. And according to the city's adjusted transient occupancy tax figures, these are the taxes derived from hotel stays, so very much reflecting tourism in our community. In 1988, the tax received was $2.4 million, and in 1998 it was $2.7 million. So that's a very minimal increase, barely keeping up with inflation over that 10-year period. And during that time, it appears that the Visitors and Convention Bureau was given about $300,000 a year over 10 years, equals over $3 million. So it appears to me that there's some very sketchy justification that we're actually benefiting in the transit occupancy tax from this expenditure. And unless, I would think there could be some kind of a proof that this money is doing us some good, perhaps we would be better served by doing something else with the money. And I realize that the current budget is pretty much set in cement for right now, but I do think that that's something that should be kept in mind for the next budget. $300,000 is a good chunk of an approximately $40 million discretionary budget. And like I said, without some kind of proof that we're actually gaining in return for this expenditure, I would think that this expenditure should be borne by private business. In this case, apparently the only private money that comes into this is in exchange for direct advertising, which is actually a cost of business and a product we see for the contribution. And I don't think that the taxpayer is getting the dollars worth of it. And I've got to thank for that. Thank you.
And that was Fred Geiger talking about the kind of business subsidy that was being given to the Chamber of Commerce and trying to get City Council to cut it off, unsuccessfully, but at least he spoke out on the issue.
Anybody here from CBC to want to address these points?
I'm not from CBC, right? Just respond briefly. People have become, particularly in the off-season, because of direct contacts with the Commission of Visitors, Office of Visitors Center, and it shows that we actually make way more money. The money that we put into them is actually an investment. It's not we spend it out of the place somewhere else. People actually come to us and spend money, not just on TOT, which is the most directly trackable amount of money, but also you can make reasonable estimates about how much we spend on sales tax for restaurants and other kinds of expenditures, why we're buying things and so forth. And clearly, we talked about this during the budget session. I'm not going to give a long speech about it because it's a detailed budget, but there is a study that actually demonstrates response to the question that I think Fred Geiger is asking, which is, does this money actually return money to the city's collectors? Now, there's an expensive study that we take, so I don't expect them to do this study every single year, but I haven't done it in 1996. But that's sort of very forceful that actually we make money when they do these things. Most important thing to say about this is the CDC, I can see its job is particularly bringing people here on July 4th during the busy summer weekends, but bringing people in the shoulder season, October, November, and then early April, May, before that. And there's clear evidence that they're successful at doing that, and in fact, they make back for the city senators in TOT and sales tax more than we would make otherwise. One of the problems with trying to track stuff, what percent of increase we have in given years, but the biggest factor in that is the weather. It's much bigger factor than anything the city does or the city or businesses or anybody else, and there's no way to control for that. It's not obvious. But so you have to look at the TOT income rates and law period of time. Make some judgment about it. So it's obviously something the council needs to look at every year. It's a large amount of money. It's really a careful Truly, the election front of us today is not that issue. The whole council voted on this already at the budget session. This is simply about giving them the contract that carries out the council already gave to you. So I will move it and adopt it.
There's a motion and a second. What's the first one?
I just want to put into the record that I think the council, when we took a vote previously, was not convinced that that this money has been, that we have not been presented. I'm not saying that the CDC is not bringing in the requisite number of tourists or tourist dollars, given what the state of the budget is, $380,000 in the general fund budget, but the information that we have at hand does not show that, portray that. And I think where the council was going last vote was they wanted to CDC to look to the private contributors more, taking a share of what the city now contributes to the convention and visitor center.
Okay, and I'll just say I vote single.
I would like to add an additional.
And what you have here is actually Christopher Crone supporting the cutoff of funding from the Chamber of Commerce, which is a positive thing. The significant dynamic here is that Fred Geiger raises an issue, and he gets support on the council from Christopher Crone, who actually votes in favor of cutting off money to this. Essentially, it's city funding of advertising for the Chamber of Commerce, which could go to hundreds of thousands of dollars. It could go to homeless funding or social services or something else. And of course, Rotkin and Matthews rush in to defend it. And they ended up with a kind of a, we'll look at it again next year sort of thing, which is kind of meaningless in one sense. In another way, it could set the tone for some real action later on, which really is the kind of the line that I think Sugar and Crone are using, which is, well, we're only 2 out of 5 votes, but if you vote in some more people in a couple years, we'll have a progressive majority. But as I said earlier, the apparently progressive or hopeful position that Crone and Sugar took around police misconduct last November has eroded severely, both in terms of how Crone and Sugar deal with advocates of police reform. When Steve Argue was recently arrested for essentially witnessing an arrest and advising, or a detention, and advising the person detained that he had certain rights, and then he was shoved, handcuffed, taken off to jail for, quote, interfering with an officer. When Crone arrived on the scene, his verbal statement was he assumed Steve Argue had done something wrong. And so his position really has taken a significant turn, as has Keith Sugar's position. Again, Keith Sugar today, in a long conversation with Becky Johnson, expressed no concern whatsoever about this crucial appointee of the Citizens Police Review Board that Cynthia Matthews made and that the council just zipped through at this kind of stealth city council meeting on Tuesday without any public discussion, without any the candidate or the person nominating the candidate being present, without the media being present, without there being any television, without anyone actually supporting the candidate publicly, without any discussion, really. It was, and Sugar's comments on this were, well, she has a right, Cynthia Matthews has a right to do what she wants. But if that was true, it was certainly, that's an erosion of the position that Sugar held 4 or 5 months ago, when as council member, he and Byers and Fitzmaurice and Crone voted not to ratify Matthews' other appointee, Bill Christie, who actually has had a lot more experience than Daniel Robin. Daniel Alper. Daniel Robin is another person. Daniel Alper. And so it tends to make me think that it sort of gives substance to the sad truth that power corrupts and office tends to make you more conservative. That's what's happened, I think, to Crone and Sugar. And it really is a sad thing. I'd love to hear from any of you out there who disagree with me. If you want to give a call, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 427-3772, 427-3772. You are tuned to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. And we're not the only radio station around. There's also a station in Berkeley, which has been having its share of controversy and public protest. And I believe I actually have the right tape here. I was up in Berkeley yesterday and the day before, and I spoke with Attorney Osha Newman. And Osha is was himself a member of Berkeley's much more, theoretically much more powerful police review board, as well as an activist and a civil rights lawyer, and a person really concerned with KPFA. In fact, so much so that he was arrested on a ladder as he climbed a ladder trying to put up a big banner, take back KPFA or some such thing. Let's hear his perspective on what's going on with radio station KPFA up in Berkeley, which is back on the air again, but still really in a precipitous, uncertain position, because it may be sold at any minute. It's supposed to be listener-supported, but right now it's in the hands of the big corporate interests of the larger Pacifica Foundation. And there's been a lot of public outcry that finally had the effect of forcing the larger corporation to at least try to finesse things by letting the workers back in the station. But they are still pressing charges against at least 100 people who nonviolently resisted the corporation's attempt to essentially shut down the station, because people in the station wanted to speak about what the corporation was doing to the station. Let's hear Osha Newman talk about that.
It's August 11th, 1999. It's about 25 to 12. I'm in the office of Osha Newman, who's an attorney and activist, and apparently a defendant as well in recent controversies concerning KPFA. Hi, Osha.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. So I saw you at the courthouse yesterday, and a bunch of other people apparently lined up for an arraignment that was delayed 10 days?
There were 52 people scheduled to be arraigned, which were the group that was arrested the day that they locked down KPFA and dragged Dennis Bernstein off the air, and we were all there ready to get arraigned, but they didn't have a judge for us, because the only judge who apparently was not on vacation in Berkeley was Judge Jenny Ryan, who happened to have been on the Pacifica board at various times and recused herself. So we hung around there for a couple of hours doing various basically meaningless tasks in the courtroom, and we were told to come back on August 20th.
What I was told by others there was this was really kind of a gross imposition on the folks there, not just you, the defendants, but also other defendants, perhaps even poorer defendants, since many of the folks arrested on in the KPFA demonstrations were perhaps more middle class and have more resources, but folks who were there had to wait hours and hours for the KPFA folks to essentially go through a process that simply was a delay, the whole thing, 10 days thing. And I guess I came up and I asked you afterward, gosh, if the arraignment isn't speedy, doesn't this prejudice the entire show? And you said, not if you're not in custody, right?
Well, the whole thing was an enormous waste of time and money and resource for everybody concerned. It was one of the things we argued in the press conference we had before, that this doesn't serve any purpose whatsoever to proceed with these prosecutions, and is a waste of time. But it's true, we're a diverse group, but there was certainly sitting out in the hall a whole bunch of people who had lives to get back to, who had to wait for 2 hours for this procedure, which really shouldn't have taken any of that amount of time. I mean, the judge, on the one hand, said she wasn't going to deal with it. On the other hand, spent all that time, two hours at least, calling everybody up individually and individually informing them they had to come back, and then issuing an order that they all had to go in and be booked and fingerprinted and mugged and so on, which again, if she couldn't even take the police, she shouldn't have done. So yeah, I mean, this is, it happened today and it's going to continue, because there are court appearances stacked up like summer storms in that court, and they're not prepared to deal with it.
How many people were involved yesterday?
There were 52 people that were arrested on that day. These were people who were arrested on July 13th, and the vast majority of them were inside the building at the time that the broadcast went over the airways that Dennis had been arrested.
Briefly, what happened that led to their arrest? Let's assume we're talking to a completely naive audience.
Well, there had been a controversy going on for a couple of months that had been sparked by the firing of a general manager, and then by
Radio station KPFA.
At KPFA, Nicole Sawaya, and then by Larry Bensky, who was, I think, 35 years had been a journalist and person who had been involved with KPFA and the Pacifica as their national political correspondent. He was fired for talking about it. And then Robbie Osmond had been fired, but on this day, Dennis Bernstein, who runs an investigative journalism show called Flashpoints, had broadcast as part of his show a press conference that had been given that day, in which the media alliance made public an email that they had received under some strange circumstances that was sent by one of the board members, a guy named Michael Palmer in Houston, to Mary Frances Berry, who's been the sort of the person who's instigated most of the problems
here.
The
Red Queen.
Yeah, and the email talked about selling the radio station, the discussions about that. So it was a fairly big news. In fact, it was front page news on most of the newspapers in this area. So he broadcast that press conference, and then minutes after his show was over, when the 6 o'clock news began, the people who were listening to it heard the news interrupted by shouts and loud argument, and heard Dennis Bernstein protesting that he was being dragged physically out of the newsroom and his concern for his safety and so on. And it was very dramatic. And after a minute or so of this, then all of a sudden the news was cut off, and it was replaced by a canned speech by someone about Marxism or something. And so when people heard this, everybody who was tuning in, the news has a wide audience, people converge in the station.
And 52 of those people were arrested?
Well, yeah, I mean, they included Dennis Bernstein and a number of other staff members. The entire news department that was there to do the news were all arrested. KPFA employees who were in the building were arrested.
And were arrested for?
Everybody's been arrested for trespassing who was inside.
Trespassing at their job.
Some people were arrested for trespassing at their job, right? Others for going in and walking in. I mean, when I got there 15 minutes later, I just simply walked in and stood in the hall. So a lot of the people were in the hall wanting to know what had happened. They were arrested for that. And then there was, while all this was going on, police arrived in force, crowd. Santa Cruz City Police?
I'm sorry. No. Berkeley. I got Santa Cruz on the mind.
Yeah.
Berkeley
City Police, University of California Police. I mean, there were a lot of cops there. And because a large crowd that had continued to stream to the location couldn't get into the station and massed outside. And then when they began to make arrests, the crowd was there, and they had a great deal of difficulty getting their paddy wagons out through the crowd. A number of people were arrested in that situation.
Now, you were an eyewitness. Do you want to, any kind of on-the-spot visual things that struck you immediately when you came in, anything that you think will be particularly newsworthy? When you arrived, what did you see?
Well, I think what's most amazing is that I arrived, it must have been about 15 minutes after the broadcast.
This is in the evening, about 6:30?
In the evening. No, it was about 6:15. Mm-hmm. And by that time, there were about 50 people had already massed in the entranceway to Pacifica. There's a kind of a hallway with an outer door and an inner door, and that whole hallway was filled with people, and there were police blocking their further entrance into the station. And you could, behind the wall of police, one could see various staff members who were there. There was Robbie Osmond and people. There were other people who were barricaded upstairs, or not barricaded, but were remaining upstairs. And there was, they had just that day brought in the station manager, a new station manager from Texas, a guy named Garland Ganter, who essentially had been brought in to ride herd.
Got the goose Garland, as we sometimes call him?
Right. And so he was the person who actually ordered Dennis Bernstein to be terminated, his position terminated, and mobilized the armed guards that Pacifica had had patrolling the building for a number of weeks before this, and ordered the, it was his citizen's arrest that request of the police to make citizen's arrests resulted in the, in fact, people being taken into custody on that day.
Now, the technical reality is, if he changes his mind and doesn't want these cases prosecuted, is that, in essence, hamstring the DA and mean that charges will in all likelihood be dropped against you?
Well, you know, I mean, technically the DA could proceed without him, but it would be extremely unusual and difficult for them to do it because he is the key complaining witness in this matter. And if the complainant, the person who claims to be injured, indicates that they don't want to be proceed with it, it would be almost unheard of for them to do it.
Now, subsequently, there was I was there the next day on July 14th, and we had there was a huge demonstration. Folks walked from intersection to intersection, waiting for the police to arrest them for civil disobedience. They wouldn't comply. We finally made it all the way down to 6th Street, I guess it was, to the edge of the freeway, and the decision was made to come back to the station and so forth. Masses of people stayed, and I guess a camp KPFA developed in front of the station, and then other developments included the concern the station would be sold. I guess a mediation effort was set up that didn't seem to go very far, where there was concern about that, and then a unilateral announcement by
Mary Frances Berry,
whose book I like, but whose policies I don't like. I liked her book on civil rights, but didn't much like the way she behaved in this situation. She just sort of announced, get back to work or we're all going to fire you, everything's okay. What's happened in the last, can you summarize events in the last week or two in KPFA as far as what's happening with the station and kind of bring us up to date?
Well, I mean, you've got this, the chronology basically right. After the 13th, there was constant protests and demonstrations outside the station. And in fact, there was a 24-hour presence there, so people called it Camp KPFA, where all sorts of people, homeless people, you know, gutter punks, you know, whatever. I mean, there were lots of
Albany settlement refugees.
Yeah, all kinds of people, and then also, you know, the others. You know, I mean, a diverse crowd of people camped there and set up tents, and there were struggles that went on for weeks with the city and the police about the what the rights of the camp to be there and whether the street would be closed and so on. And that resulted in a number of arrests on various occasions.
The city spent a lot of money on that, right?
The whole thing has cost the city a lot of money, yeah, and they really didn't want to. I mean, on the 13th, they really attempted to, police chief was there, he really attempted to get figure out a way that they didn't have to make the arrests. But, yeah, it cost the city a lot of money. And then there were more arrests, there was, you know, throughout.
All in all, would you estimate how many were arrested?
Probably close to 100. Mm-hmm. And then after all these arrests, after the, you know, these escalating protests and also escalating national attention to it, essentially the progressive communities and figures, renowned figures in the progressive movement throughout the country came out in support of KPFA and castigating Pacifica and the...
Pacifica is the parent corporation that was attempting the firings and also
right.
Has kind of been winnowing people out and appealing to kind of vanilla eyes and dilute KPFA's previous community control programming?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of issues about why the Pacifica has been doing what it's doing, but essentially it's been a power grab that where they wanted to centralize control of the whole network and take all decision making away from the community. And the intent does seem to be to change the nature of those stations so that they are fit more into some kind of a corporate mode. Not clear.
NPR type format?
Yeah, maybe. You know, that's certainly part of it. I mean, I think, you know, something possibly that would be more congenial to the, you know, like caucus of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Clintonoid stations, or something.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think so. I mean, I think it's what they want would allow them to put in the mix some, you know, progressive programming. There's a national program like Democracy Now! It's a very good program that they've been sponsoring. But overall, the sound of the station would, there'd be much less news, much less investigative reporting, much less alternative cultural presentations, much less diversity, although that despite the fact that they have claimed, Pacifica, that a lot of what they're doing has been in the name of diversity. But
Marion, what's her name again?
Mary Frances Berry.
Mary Frances Berry has said that she's concerned about increasing the power of people of color in the station, and getting rid of those old white male hippies,
right,
that are causing all the trouble?
Right. Although, you know, where they've instituted these policies in other stations, it had the exact opposite effect. And they, and particularly in Berkeley, what they did was fire a Lebanese woman and replace her with a white man from Texas. So, that...
Nicole Sawaya.
Yeah, Nicole Sawaya is the person who was fired. So that they're... Has that, the credibility of that particular argument has not been very strong, given the sort of overwhelming opposition of communities of color here. It's not that people here don't believe that there are issues at KPFA that need to be dealt with around its level of diversity and openness to people of color, but nobody feels that this is the way to do it.
Well, I know the city council initially kind of deadlocked on a resolution. Then the next week, according to Chris Worthington, who was also at this court hearing yesterday, a council member from the Telegraph Avenue area in Berkeley, told me that most of the council went along, not unanimously, but by heavy majorities, urging not just supporting the KPFA workers and staffers and the local folks who, you know, stayed in the station and resisted the police occupation, but also kind of deploring the use of police, although perhaps not as strong a resolution as some had originally wanted?
Yeah, that's essentially right. I mean, ultimately, the resolution that the city council... That the city council passed unanimously was very clear and unequivocal in the support of KPFA and demand that Pacifica stop the policies that produced this crisis. And it's had, KPFA and has had very, very broad support, not just in Northern California, but also in all the other communities where there are Pacifica stations, where people realize that what's happening in KPFA is just a harbinger of what's to come, or, you know, in some cases, what they see a resistance to something that has happened at their station that they wished hadn't happened.
Now, the Chronicle and the Examiner are telling us that everything has kind of been resolved, all is rosy, although actually there's some of the stories are a little more complex than that, that the staff has been allowed back in the station, that everything's kind of being negotiated. What actually has happened in KPFA now?
Well, what's happened is, I mean, that it's certainly not over by any means. What happened is that because of this really unprecedented mobilization here and nationwide, and the very, very bad publicity that Pacifica was getting, they were not able to spin this in a way that worked. They they finally reversed course insofar as they agreed to a somewhat ambiguous proposal to have people go back in the station, essentially run the station as they wished for a limited period of time on a trial basis. Now, what they have not done is relinquish control, change the governing structure of Pacifica, or take off the table the sale of Pacifica. And everybody who's involved in this is very much aware and concerned that the crisis is far from over, and that the what Pacifica is doing is most likely a change of strategy, but not a change of goal, and that they we see no reason to believe that they've given up the idea of selling the station, and they may very well use the financial crisis, which they have provoked by their actions and by the enormous costs they have incurred in security, in lawyers, in public relations firms.
They hired a new public relations firm.
They hired a public lawyer. They had a person in house, and you know, she was not doing very well. And then they hired this firm of Feynman and Associates, which is most well known for representing the Odwalla company after its E. coli epidemic. And so I guess they figured this was sort of political E. coli. But they quit after maybe about a week, and the day before this mass march that took place, where there were about 15,000 people. So